This Writers' Centre Norwich recording features readings by writers invited to the 2015 World's Literature Festival. Find out more at writerscentrenorwich.org.uk.
Her most recent work is a collection of short stories and a novel. But this afternoon she'll read to us from an earlier work, The Poet Who Forgot, a memoir about her youthful friendship with the Australian poet A.D. Hope. As a young woman, Cathy wrote to A.D. Hope to thank him for his poems. The two became friends, with Alec Hope encouraging and mentoring Cathy's development as a writer. The memoir opens with Cathy's discovery that her letters to Alec Hope are now in the National Library with a 50-year embargo on them. As she travels to Canberra to read them, she shares the trepidation about what she'll find of her youthful self and the effect that exposure of these letters, albeit in 50 years' time, will have on her own reputation. And I quote, "So small a folder for this task, a journey into the metaphysics of the past self, a re-entry into the zone of embarrassment or lost hope." The Poet Who Forgot is a moving exploration of the role of letters, diaries, and friendship, particularly poignant in this age of emo. Cathy.
And I should also say, Alec Hope got dementia and forgot even that he was a poet or that he had a fine reputation as Australia's greatest poet. Parramatta Road, twilight, a teetering time when the sky prevaricates between day and night. Planes fly low over inner west rooftops, the passengers looking down at cars and passengers in cars looking up. The neon lights haven't yet come on and the air is cellophane. Exhaust fumes add green, the lowering sun ochre, and all the nostalgic drive time songs add something else, an anguished purple, a sexy pink, a blue note. Your memories, take your pick. Words don't come easy to me. Writing a new book is like entering a love affair, your heart all dried up, an old walnut webby in your chest suddenly blossoms into a nut tree. Ideas wake you at dawn, you're panting with them, really. Notebook never where it should be, you let the ideas take you, roll over, go back to sleep. Abandoned at seven, perfidious pen, all that pre-dawn lyricism spent. Past the witches' houses on Johnston Street, ideas rising up to the witch hat points. At five this morning, the muse suggested, and as you turn onto the crescent, the scent of low tide vaginal, the Anzac Bridge, a blaze of sunset windscreens. Yes, you say, yes, that was it. And so you begin. In the early 1980s, when I was a fledgling writer with designs on myself as a poet, I wrote to A.D. Hope, whose poetry seemed to exemplify those three attributes Nabokov cites as essential to a writer, those of storyteller, teacher, enchanted. I wanted to tell Hope how much I'd enjoyed the poems I'd studied at university in my Australian literature course that year. This passion wasn't a new thing. I'd loved poetry since little. Robert Louis Stevenson, Walter Delamere, Robert Browning. Long narratives about Pied Pipers and Lorelei Rocks and highwaymen recited en masse loudly in stifling summer classrooms. Rats. They fought the dogs and killed the cats and bit the babies in their cradles. Poetry to enliven dull suburban afternoons. In fourth class, I first encountered Douglas Stewart's poem about a woman who fed the domain stray cats. She smiles and walks back lightly to the slums. If she has fed their bodies, they have fed more than the body in her. They purr like drums. Their tails are banners and fountains inside her head. The times are hard for exiled aristocrats, but gracious and sweet it is to be queen of the cats. I read it out loud, the blowflies circling languidly overhead, the boy at the next desk resting his hot forehead on perspiration's sticky arms, wondering, as I grappled with Stuart's words, whether such fountains were the source of our sweat. And to this day, I still see the cat's banner tails, striped, fluffy, sunbent like question marks, drawn in the class exercise that followed. Teachers always seemed to get us to illustrate poems back then. Slessor's poems hit me like a sledgehammer when I was 15. You find this ugly, I find it lovely. Right at the awkward time, I was discovering Sydney's more interesting quarters, especially King's Cross, with its great palette splash of neon at the top of William Street. It all seemed so cosmopolitan, just like Paris or London or New York, cities to which I'd not yet journeyed. I learned that Slessor lived somewhere in the Cross when I rented my first flat in Victoria Street, Potts Point, and I often thought of visiting him. Captain Dobbin, that's who he'd be like, and we'd catch a ferry around the harbour, past the white buoy towers, and talk of seaweed and clinking beer bottles. Slessor would have been thrilled to hear from you, A.D. Hope would say years later. He'd gone through a crisis of confidence just before he died, and a knock on the door from an enthusiastic fan would have lifted his spirits. I didn't knock. A.D. Hope was very much alive in Canberra and fated as Australia's greatest living poet, so I conversed instead with the poet who was left. But for the moment, I'm composing a letter. What did I say? Dear Mr. Hope, I am writing just to say how much I loved. I think that's what I wrote. The letter of the word struck, the writer looking for a mentor, the bird writer with newly feathered wings. Bird metaphors, someone said of my early poetic efforts. There are so many birds in your work. Turning the Victoria Road, the rats scrambled to form one lane, then up the hill into Balmain, the old car straining a bit. Home in reach, no steaming radiator, no sudden inexplicable stops. I didn't drive then, I wasn't even a fledgling driver. I rode a bike around Sydney's inner west, and when I went to live in Canberra, I rode a bike around there as well. For every bird, there is this last migration, the Gulf of Mexico. A.D. Hope explained the poem's genesis over a whiskey. A new writer also seeks inside information. It's nearly dark when I arrive home. My writer friend is waiting to go for a walk. The perfect time of day for it. Daylight saving ended, the evening coming in tight like a belt or a drawstring. It's autumn, and Balmain's jacarandas are defiantly bulking. A neighbour is having a Chinese elm root pruned, and we look at the offending roots, which have pried their way into the house's foundations, needle thin, expanding to crack the soft sandstone. Poetry does this, Trojan horse words entering, expanding, illuminating. They sack you too, the cat's tails, the silken tent in a field, the bird's last flight, the last duchess on the wall. Like the elm tree, they give new meaning to rooted. Too many birds, too many trees, walnuts, elms, jacarandas, too many words like music's critics complaining, too many notes. Words infect writers. We collect them and adopt them, like Nabokov's Nacreous, relating to typical of or made of mother of pearl. I lusted after that Lolita word, have already used it. A passion for unfamiliar words I need to look up, the meaning only important to avoid inappropriate use. Bright little pearl words whose sound or demeanour on the page are enough. Cerulean. A deep blue colour like the sky on a clear day, crepuscular, relating to or resembling the fading light of dusk. Word accents of unknown origins, their magic resting in the ebb and flow of unfamiliar sounds, but birds and trees, well, they're logical, as are loss, love, death, exhaust fume, music tinted sunsets, crepuscular, at the end of working days when your soul has been shredded. And in the sky above Birch Grove Oval, a bird, a plane, its wings as wide as the continents it's traversed, an Inca bird, a condor heading for the airport. The attraction of poetry and poets? Well, poets use words differently from other people. Clown word jugglers, strip show shockers, smooth talkers, experiment loving lovers, landscape gougers. Poetry does something other literary forms can't do. It tells charade stories, only the hands moving, leaves the face, tickles the ears. How do poets do it? Is it knowing the trade secrets that make poets such odd people? My writer friend and I turn away from the elm, the jacarandas, the street, and walk faster than usual, pleased with ourselves. The cooler dark night has given us wings. Do walking writers talk about their work? Sometimes. But writers are superstitious. Words do that fading thing, the fading dawn idea, the fading sentence that won't finish itself. I'll talk about what I'm working on, touch wood, but it's early days yet. And in the west, the last of the sun fades into an apricot line. Crepuscule. What word better offers the ugularity of the egg sun dropping, its yolk smearing the sky? Crepuscule could be an eggshell cracking, sun smeared lips parted over teeth, playful kitten's asses. I wrote to Adie Hope because I wanted to talk to him about his work. Adie Hope wrote back, "When you're next in Canberra, please look us up," words to that effect. I was surprised. Writers replied to fan mail. Would I have been disappointed if he hadn't? Probably. Adie Hope was of a polite generation. I used the letter as a bookmark, lost it with a book. In a second-hand bookshop or St. Vincent de Paul store or a market rests a novel, Good Grass is a Tin Drum, and inside it a yellowing missive from an old poet to a young woman who's ostensibly said thanks for the poems. On Sunday afternoons, I like to take the past down from the shelves, reacquaint. Adie Hope's letters are kept in a box, all in their original envelopes. It's an archivist's nightmare, I'm sure, the pages already stained tea brown. With them reside the letters I received about my early writing from Dennis Haskell, encouraging, Geoffrey Dutton, enthusiastic, Alan Wern, uncertain. I read these too. Why didn't I take the poet's advice, rewrite, resubmit? I've forgotten. It hardly matters now, though seeing the poems typed on an old typewriter, neatly folded, returned, editing suggestions, scribbled in pencil, shyly disregarded, makes me want to try again. Older Catherine, marking up younger Catherine's work. I can barely constrain myself from giving her a grade. Autumn Sunday afternoons offer this particular kind of reflection. The summer gone, we're back on real time. It gets dark when it should, early. Where did the summer go? Why didn't I spend more time at the beach, picnicking, drinking champagne at the water's edge? Reading more poetry. 5 o'clock Sundays when the past is let out to gloat. And downstairs, Brahms' violin concerto is adding its own regrets. Sunday evening is the time to prepare for the next day, an old habit, a rehearsal for Monday's responsibilities. Tomorrow I'll teach young people to write, the irony of this not lost on me. Most of my students write very well already, with a confidence that surprises and sometimes causes pain. How did they get to 18 without the shackles of self-doubt? Few of them read poetry, though they have their own poets, musicians, songwriters, singers, the poets of the screen who create words from images. I make them read Plath and Ginsberg, E. Cummings, because the lowercase delights, T.S. Eliot, Neruda. The students write their own poems in class, too many words, too much description. We do class exercise to pair their poems back, excising calluses, the adjectives that smother. Poetry is the core into which you fall. I enjoy truisms like that, believing they make my students think. 6 o'clock, the coming week's practicalities addressed, and a beautiful Sunday afternoon, old photos, old friends, past lives, segue into ironing, shoe cleaning and briefcase packing, and paper sorting and duty phone calls. The poems, the letters go back on the shelf. Tomorrow, above all, I will try to offer my students what Adie Hope offered me, encouragement, teach them to write as in the French, on courage, encourage. In the box of Adie Hope letters, the young me resides, self-doubting, self-assured, far too old by the time I wrote to so gaucherly express myself so openly to someone I hardly knew. I read Adie Hope's replies to letters of which I kept no copies, read myself between his lines. An invitation to his home in Forest, friendly chat about his work in Sydney, his cat's goings on. There is an offer to co-write a book, a poem dedicated to a day we spent at Manly Beach, a translation directly from the Russian of an Anna Akhmatova poem. Sunday afternoon, the reading lamp casting its own shadows on the stained pages, a ghost silk reading with me. Over the years, the timbre of the letters changed. I minded Hope's house, shared stories with Hope's wife. Looking back, I can see how distrustful Penelope must have been, another young protege, another young woman. Her letters seemed to heave a sigh of relief when she realised I wasn't interested in her husband. I wasn't silly. I had lovers in Sydney. I certainly wasn't interested in a septuagenarian one in Canberra. What was I interested in? Some sense of what it's like to live a life dedicated to words, or some insights into the trials and tribulations of a poet's life as extolled by Alec in his poem, Advice to a Poet. So tell them they will not believe you. They will not even comprehend what you say about the planet. They will jeer at the crystal you carry in your hands. But tell them, their need to be forgiven will make them listen. Listen yourself for the minute when their tears break through as somebody understands. Thanks. Thank you very much, Cathy. Now I'm delighted to welcome Jonty Driver, another of our regulars, back to Norwich. Born in South Africa, but exiled for many years, Jonty Driver is now resident in England. He's a poet, novelist, and essayist. He's published 5 novels, 7 collections of poetry, and 2 biographies. This afternoon, he'll be reading to us from one of those biographies, which will be published later this year by the Crane River Press. The Man with the Suitcase, the Life, Execution, and Rehabilitation of a Liberal Terrorist, is about John Harris, who is highly regarded by black Africans, less so by most white South Africans. 50 years ago, Harris was hanged for having placed a bomb in the concourse of Johannesburg Station, which caused the death of a bystander and injured others nearby. Although Harris had warned the press and the police about the bomb, no effort was made to clear the concourse, with tragic results. This biography is a sympathetic re-examination of this episode. Jonty.
I'm reading the opening couple of pages, then a bit from the middle, and then a bit from the end. At tea time on the afternoon of Friday, the 24th of July, 1964, a young white South African, John Harris, put down in the main concourse of Johannesburg Station, a new concourse in those days, glass and concrete, light and airy, but for whites only, slechts for blankets. A large brown suitcase containing 8 sticks of dynamite, a quantity of cord tacks, a 2-gallon plastic container of petrol, a tiny device adapted from a pocket, an electric battery and 2 detonators. On the suitcase was a handwritten note saying, "Terug binnen 10 minuten," back in 10 minutes. At about 4:15, he telephoned the railway police and 2 newspapers. He spoke in English to the Rant Daily Mail. The reporter who took the message thought it was the voice of a black South African, and in fluent Afrikaans to the Transvaal. He said he was speaking on behalf of the African resistance movement, that there was a bomb in the station and that the station should be cleared at once. Although the newspapers passed their information to the police, in the time that elapsed, apparently no action was taken. Listen carefully. This is an important message. This is the African resistance movement. Can you hear me? There is a time bomb somewhere in the main concourse of Johannesburg Station. On the handle of the suitcase is a label bearing a message. It will go off at 4:33. Don't touch it. It is not our intention to harm anyone. Clear the concourse by using the public address system at once. Do not try to defuse the bomb as the suitcase is triggered to explode if it is opened. Several people said afterwards that they had seen the man leaving the suitcase, but descriptions were vague. It was tall, young, and wore a dark suit, some said a dark overcoat. Soon after he had gone away, four people came to sit on one of the benches in the concourse. Mrs. S. Ethel Rees, in her 70s, her daughter, Mrs. Ethel Burley, and two granddaughters, Carol, 13, and Glynis, 12. Ethel Rees had come to the station to say goodbye to her daughter and granddaughters, who were catching a train home after a brief visit. Mrs. Burley and Carol went to look into shop windows a little way away, leaving Glynis and her grandmother sitting on a bench. At precisely 16:33, the suitcase exploded. 23 adults and children were injured, most of them by the burning petrol, some badly. One of them, Glynis Burley, was scarred for life. Less than 4 weeks later, her grandmother died of bronchial pneumonia, brought on by the injuries caused by a bomb. This was no longer political demonstration nor sabotage, but particularly if intention could be proved, murder. The police, in fact, arrested him that later that evening. As sure as I can be that they had been told 4 hours beforehand that there was going to be a bomb in the station, and it's still a puzzle why they didn't make any attempt to clear the station. That's one of the questions I address in the book. Harris was a well-known political activist already. He was chairman of the South African Non-Racial Olympic Committee, and in many ways the most hated white man in South Africa, because South Africans are mad about sport. Anyway, he was arrested, and this is an account of one of the things that happened to him while he was arrested. In general, white prisoners, whatever they were suspected of, were not beaten up with the same savage enthusiasm as black prisoners, though they were often made to stand in a small chalk square for hour upon hour while they were questioned. However, the station bomb seemed to blot out any inhibition. Gordon Wintergate gives this account of what happened to John Harris. Soon after his arrest, he was interrogated by Captain J.J. Victor. Winter writes, "Victor later boasted to me how he had persuaded John Harris to make a full confession within 5 minutes. This is roughly what he told me. One of the latest tricks in interrogation is to lull the suspect into a false sense of security. You can start by being over friendly with him and then suddenly scream like a maniac," said Victor. "I've always believed the only way to make a man talk is to give him a bloody good hiding. But there's something to be said for these newfangled psychological methods. I tried my own variation and it worked." Victor said that he first sat Harris down on a chair in the middle of the room. Then he told him, "Look, John, you're a member of the South African Liberal Party, so I know you're not the kind of man to go around blowing people up with bombs. So I'm not going to waste my time trying to interrogate you about the station blast. Instead, they would have a chat about sport." When I asked him to name his favourite sport, Harris said he preferred playing cricket and tennis. I told him I was mad about rugby, but that I always had the ash of my drop kick. Harris said he was a keen student of rugby, but didn't actually play the games, it was too rough for him. Victor then picked up a newspaper, crumpled it into a ball, and walked back to the far wall with it. He ran forward 3 or 4 steps and drop kicked the ball of paper at a table in the corner. Aristonian knew at once when my kicks were running wide, and said I swung my foot out as I kicked, which shook the ball off course. I thanked him for his advice, picked up the ball and newspaper, and carried it back to the wall. I ran forward and delivered a massive kick, not at the ball, but right on John Harris's jaw. Harris leapt backwards and somersaulted over the back of the chair. As he lurched to his knees, he swayed dizzily, cupped his chin in both hands, and blood spurted from his mouth as he coughed. Victor kicked him again on the chin and then once in the stomach. I'll talk, for Christ's sake, don't kick me again, you've broken my jaw, Harris managed to mumble. He'd suffered two fractures to the jaw. The injuries to the jaw were still apparent when, weeks later, Harris was visited by his lawyer, Ernie Lensall. A kick to the stomach that Winter mentioned was, in fact, a kick in the testicles. They were still badly bruised weeks later. He was put on trial. I think probably mistakenly, his lawyers pleaded temporary insanity. The judge found that he was perfectly sane. I think he was perfectly sane. And he, 6 months later, he was hanged. I'm reading now from closer to the end of the book. Opinion among white South Africans about what John Harris did still divides widely. Some think that what he did was properly defined as murder, or at the least that no end justifies the means of political violence that results in the death of innocents. It is still argued by some commentators that he knew not just what he was risking when he put the bomb in the station, but that he intended to kill, as he had warned he might do in a letter he never sent. That view of his actions would not necessarily mean that they approved, at the time or later, of the execution. But several people who might have forgiven him have refused to do so, even 40 years on. What had been wrong was still wrong, and attendance would have seemed to them like justification. John Harris had himself certainly realized that acts of sabotage might cause death or damage, even to innocents, and had thought it was a risk that must be taken for the greater cause. That's fine. But if old Mrs. Reese had been my grandmother, or Glynis my daughter, I might have felt differently. Of course, one death and a few disfigurements may seem a very minor matter in the scale of suffering, even in that one country alone. However, I remember always that in Kuster's Darkness at Noon, when Rubbishoff is contemplating the eye, the cipher 2-4 and the tappings code, the grammatical fiction of selfhood, on the last night before his execution, he thinks, the sole object of revolution was the abolition of senseless suffering. But if it had turned out that the removal of the second kind of suffering was only possible at the price of a temporary enormous increase in the sum total of the first, so the question now ran, was such an operation justified? Obviously, it was, if one spoke in the abstract of mankind, but applied to man in the singular, the cipher 2-4, the real human being of bone and flesh and blood and skin, the principle led to absurdity. Black South Africans, and black Africans generally, seem to have no problem in regarding John Harris as a hero. One of the few, or too few, honourable white people, fully deserving commemoration. On the day of Harris's execution, Eddie Daniels, the member of the African resistance movement given the longest sentence, 15 years, all of which he served, had organised a gathering of prisoners on Robben Island. One of those present was Nelson Mandela. Most South Africans seem at least to acknowledge that, because there were white people like John Harris, When the change came, it did not involve the all-out bloodbath which might have happened. Nor has there been the kind of subsequent nationwide retribution that there might have been. Not every white man and woman was complicit in injustice, which has made it easier in general for the victims to forgive white men and women for that injustice. Not everyone shares my own high regard for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, since some see it as lacking in truth and short on justice, whatever it did to promote forgiveness. But if the new South Africa had taken the Nuremberg trials as its model, rather than trying to find truth and reconciliation, it might now be a rather less peaceful place than it seems to be, for the time being.